Welcome to Farming Aotearoa with Peter Burke. Kia ora, Catherine Scullin here with another edition of Farming Aotearoa, a program featuring agricultural journalist Peter Burke, who takes us through some of the main topics of interest in the rural sector in the past month. So, Pete, what have you got for us this time, and do you still have your Kiwi accent?
Yes, I know. I've been to that place, that little island off the west coast of New Zealand. I think they call it Australia a strain or something like that. It is a strain on our economy. It is a strain on our economy for a whole lot of reasons. So I've been around there. Interesting enough, I didn't go specifically for agriculture, but it was interesting for the first time in my life. I've been to Australia a lot of times, but I hadn't really been out to the outback, I suppose you can call it, or the plains, and just to see the endless horizons of wheat and canola. And I was quite staggered to see this the extent of the Australian, arable sector, if you like.
Yeah.
We saw a few sheep. We saw a few goats on the side of the road. We missed most of those. Kangaroos lying dead along the road, all the way. It's sort of part of the deal. But that was the big thing, the underlying thing for me, and the fact that there were no irrigators there, which was rather beautiful. The New Zealand countryside is polluted, in my view, by irrigators, and especially in places like the Mackenzie country, where I know I'll probably annoy a few people by saying so, but I think there was a bit of a – they're probably necessary, but they're a bit of a scourge on the landscape, in my view. Anyway. I only mess up half the audience by saying that. The other half will probably agree with me.
It is something to be seen, though. It's very hard to describe that amount of anything there, like basically flat land that just goes for miles and miles and miles and miles, or kilometres.
It is, and I suppose for me, those who, you know, extol the virtues of these e-cars, well, go to Australia with one of them and we'll see where you end up, because I know our trip from Broken Hill down to Mildura was, 5 hours without anything that looked like a petrol station on the way, looked like a house on the way. So if you had an e-car, you'd stay there on the side of the road and have a happy little, you know, time basking in the sun for a few days. So it goes to show that sort of concept is lovely but silly, in my view.
However. Oh, you have to be very careful in Australia what you do. You've got to make sure you're getting enough water and all sorts.
So anyway, absolutely. But I was quite staggered to think that, you know, we travel for, I bet you can say, Wellington to almost to beyond Taupo and almost to Rotorua without seeing another village on the way.
Yeah.
And that was interesting for me to see that. And I've learned a lot. My eyes were opened, especially looking for kangaroos at night.
Oh, gosh.
We had to do that for 2 hours.
Oh, man, but some of those kangaroos out there are enormous.
They're not babies, are they?
They're not babies at all. No, they are very large beings.
Anyway, I'm back home on the range, as it were. And on that subject, talking about grain again, because there's a bit of an interesting thing happening. We've heard a lot in the last month or two in New Zealand about the energy crisis and its effect, sadly, on the paper mills in around Wairu and Kuni, that sort of Tangawai. But interestingly enough, there was another potential crisis looming in New Zealand around energy, and it's affecting the grain industry in New Zealand. There are a couple of things to firstly put in place. There is no problem in the South Island because most of the grain is wheat and barley, and it's harvested by farmers who own their own silos, so therefore it's stored and dried in their own. But in the North Island, maize silage is not affected because it doesn't have to be dried, but ordinary maize grain has to be. And that is not stored on farm, it's stored in granaries and places where it can be dried. The problem at the moment is that there is fears that there will not be the gas that fires up these dryers.
Oh.
And there was question marks around whether the grain that's used mainly for dairy as sort of a supplementary feed, but also in the poultry and other areas as well. There's a real question mark hanging over what could happen in the next few months with those who put out contracts for that, such as the seed companies, saying, well, we don't know what it's going to cost us. Is the gas going to be there, firstly? And secondly, if it is, what is going to be the price? Therefore, what can we afford to pay the farmers who grow that seed for us? And at the moment, there is no answers. Federated farmers have been out there trying to bring all the parties together and doing a pretty good job. But at this stage, there's something of a question mark hanging over what might happen. There is, I suspect, going to be less grain grown this year anyway, in May silage probably, because of apparently a bit of a disaster last year. Imports may well have an impact on it as well. But it could put up the cost of grain for farmers, which is, you know, not quite what we were looking for. And so I think looking at that situation, grain could be an important part, and it's a worry at the moment. So it's a case of hold your breath, wait and see, see what happens. No answers yet. We'll know maybe in a few weeks' time. There was talk that even that contracts might be let, but with a clause that says we can't guarantee what the price will be in the end. Now, that's pretty not a very nice thing for people to grow, and will they grow it? I don't know. It's, interesting, eh?
Gee, that is interesting. Everything's so connected, isn't it?
It is. I mean, we think of farming as only being farming, but actually it's tied in with everything. It's transport, it's
economics,
it's energy, it's all the stuff in the world. And that flows back into, backfills of the economy of all the towns around the country, particularly the rural towns, and back into the big cities. And the other day I was up in Palmerston North talking to the mayor of Palmerston North, Grant Smith, a very great guy who does a great job for that city and for the region. And he talks about, while Palmerston North is a city, they feel the backlash of any problems in the rural areas. It comes back to them as well. So there, he's conscious of the fact that he might be a city, but he's also a rural city, and that his economy, the economy of the Palmerston North, hinges to a large degree or to a significant degree on what happens in the ag sector in his hinterland around that. That whole Manawatu Rangitiki area, particularly. So interesting, isn't it, that we get that, that we see that. We don't see it so much in Wellington, probably. Most of our beloved friends in the government agencies don't, a lot of them don't go beyond Johnsonville. But anyway, that's another issue. Anyway, I better not be facetious again. That's
good. He's been cheeky. He's been hanging around the Australians too much. They're very cheeky, aren't they?
They aren't they, yes. I can tell. I won't tell Australian jokes, I'll get into trouble for that. I know.
Okay, talk to me about wairoa.
Wairoa is interesting. I have a great soft spot for wairoa. I've been there a number of times now. And the mayor of wairoa is a guy called Craig Little. And if anyone deserves a knighthood, this guy does. He is the absolute amazing individual. I've met a lot of mayors in my life, and I don't think I've met a better one than Craig Little. And I say that because he's absolutely dedicated to his town. He's a hard-working guy. He's a farmer himself in his own right. He's got a farm. And he is trying to battle, I won't put an adjective in front of it, but bureaucrats is the word, but I'd like to put an adjective beginning with B in front of it as well. In particular, Hawke's Bay Regional Council. It's a combination of things. You probably recall that in June, Wairoa was devastated by flooding. Mm. Wairoa blames Hawke's Bay Regional Council for not being quick enough to cut the bar to allow the river to flow out to the sea. There was debate over that, to be fair. There has been a report commissioned, produced by a guy called Mike Bush, who some of you will recall was the former police commissioner, who's just released his report in the last few days. And he acknowledges the trauma that has been inflicted upon Wairoa. They had Gabriel, which devastated the rural area. Now they've got the June floods, which devastated the town particularly. Hundreds of houses, uninhabitable, damaged, uninsured, some of them. People living on a knife edge. And there are still people in the rural areas who, since Gabriel, still haven't got proper access to their houses yet, their farms.
It's terrible.
They've got goat tracks. So Craig Little is saying to Hawke's Bay Regional Council, you've got it wrong. How about an apology for it? And Hawke's Bay Regional Councillor doing a bit of a dance around this one and not being prepared to admit liability. And I think that is causing grief and is not helping the relationship between the Regional Council and the District Council. And talking to Craig the other day, he was simply saying to me, you know, it's time that the HBRC admitted they did something wrong. And that's, and by not doing that, there's still a problem, and the situation will not be improved until they do that. So the idea of getting the council and the two councils together will never work until Hawke's Bay suddenly puts on the mayor corporate hat and says, sorry, we stuffed up. And I think they have to do that. If they don't, then there is a risk that whole thing will break down as a relationship, and Hawke's Bay Regional Council will again become one of those councils that are showing signs of deterioration. in the modern environment. To be fair, it's been said, and Bush agrees with it, that cutting the bar might not have solved the problem. But there's also a comment made that the Cook's Bay Regional Council did not listen to the advice of locals and did not absorb local knowledge, which was there. And I think that's the feeling that the little township feels like it's being not listened to by the bureaucrats down in Hastings, and that it's still being left out, tongue out to dry, and a lot of PR bullshit, to be frank with you, being dished out. And, you know, we all know what that looks like. It should be written on toilet paper, not on paper, because it's so pathetic. That's what's happening. And I'm really sad about that. And I'm sad because I know Craig Little quite well, and this guy works like we wouldn't know what. He said to me the other day he had a lucky break. The lucky break was he broke his leg, he said, because it meant he had to stay at home and rest.
Okay, right.
And he couldn't get out on the farm like he did, therefore he's had to make some changes around his own farm. But that guy has given his heart, his soul, everything to that town. And when I look at the honours list and see some of the people that get things, I think Craig Little should be up there at the top getting a knighthood, because he's done more for rural communities than most I've seen have done. So I'm going to almost campaign for the fact that Little should get something damn big and not be in the award should not reflect the size of the town. It should reflect the size of the Parliament for what he's done to giving Wairoa its best. He's claiming, and he's right, that the government have done something but not done enough for the town. And what we're seeing, of course, in local authorities, don't get me onto it, but I mean, we've got stupid cycleways in Wellington all over the show, which are designed to cool people and dare I say it, meet the needs of a few. When I see people in Wairoa who can't get to hospital easily, that's a 3-hour drive to Napier Hospital because the road isn't fixed. They've still got 9 sets of traffic lights between Wairoa and Napier. It's one way for a good third of the journey, you know. Anyway, so interesting to see talk to Wairoa about that, and I think it's interesting that they're still, you know, from Gabriel onwards, still problems there. I mean, for just another example for farmers, normally their trucking firms would be able to do 2 trips a day to take stock from Wairoa down to the work, the sale yards in Hawke's Bay. They only get 1.5 loads per day on average now, so they're losing half a day virtually, or a third of a day by the road being what it is, and that's not going to be fixed easily.
Yeah.
So sympathy for Wairoa, call out for Wairoa, and if you think Wairoa is great, then give Craig Little a ring and say we like you, mate, you're a good guy.
Yeah, okay. Gee, they're doing it tough, aren't they? Yeah, I think there's a lot of people agree with you with regards to the Wellington Cycleway. I've seen many evidence that says you do the entire city or you don't bother.
I think Wellington's a basket case. I mean, I've been in the media for 60 years now, and I've never seen such an incompetent council in my entire life. And I've seen a lot of them, but I've never seen one so toxic, so incompetent as this one. And it's, you know, there might be some good individuals here. I'm sure. But I think as a council, they seem to be...
Just seems a bit common sense.
A dog would need the breakfast they produce at the moment. It's so bad.
Yeah. It's crazy. All right, I'll move you off that one, actually.
I better do. I better not stay there. I'll get into trouble. Anyway.
Talk to me about skills that are needed in the future.
Yeah, I mean, interesting piece this. I was talking to a very prominent agricultural consultant, James Allen, who was the managing director of Ag First, which is a big nationwide agricultural consultancy in New Zealand. James is a specialist in dairy. He's also the chairman of the National Field Days in Hamilton, a highly respected individual who has been overseas on a Nuffield scholarship. He spent the last year travelling around the world, looking to, with the view of trying to work out what are they going to be the needs, what are going to be the skills that will be needed for the future agricultural consultants in New Zealand, and to understand the different technologies that are emerging around the world. And how can we get people into the industry now or train them for the industry of the future? Now, we know that agricultural consultants, the role has changed many times over the years. It's not new. It was originally a very simple thing. We go back to the 50s when radio was used extensively to farmers to tell them about what to do. And there was a thing called the Farmers Journal, which was a very popular magazine that went out and did all that thing. Then we had the Ministry of Agriculture, as it was known then, had its own advisors. These were seen as independent advisors based all around the country that went out to farms and helped the farmers to give them advice to get their farms in order. And that was a very, very good service. When the Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries was dismembered by one or other of the governments, but that destroyed that. And that's not to say it was a bad thing, but it certainly changed things. Unlike another country similar to ours, Ireland, which has retained that sort of system whereby there are farm advisors right through to the... There's an unbroken link from the farm advisor through to the policy manager right in the head office of the Irish Ministry for Agriculture, which I think is a good idea, and I think what we've got is a bad idea. Now, that aside, we can't change it. We have consultancies. But what James is doing, I think, has been really interesting, going around and saying, what sort of things will we need? What sort of skills will these people need? And he's come back with a very comprehensive report on this, and saying things like, well, they're going to have good basic agricultural skills still. They're still going to have a good understanding of farm systems. You can't get away from it. You can't just say you can come onto a farm with great data skills. You've got to have a fundamental understanding of farm systems. So effectively saying the old Bachelor of Ag Science degree is still relevant to a consultancy. But as part of that package, you're going to have to learn how to deal with big databases and to extract data and to find the relevant pieces of data that fit the needs of the farmer that you're dealing with, the consultancy. There may be some specialist areas, there may be some types of skills which are needed, which will be, I guess, one-off ones, where you might have a special agronomist, perhaps. I don't know, that's just an example, but probably the wrong one. Or there may be a database specialist. But by and large, everyone is going to have that knowledge. And I think we're seeing this moving, the technology moving very, very quickly. But the one thing he said, which I think is fascinating, is that despite all those things, we're still going to have a consultant who has an empathy with people, who's got good people skills. You can have all the technical skills in the world, but if you can't relate to the farmer or the people that you're dealing with, then you're not going to hitch the ride, as it were. And what he's saying also is that as we move to a situation where our farms become bigger, I mean, we're seeing an aggregation of farming now. We've got what I call family corporates, particularly in the dairy sector. We're seeing that in other areas as well. But those farms, and you've got it in Māori as well, you've got large entities which have, 10,000 farms and how many cows, whatever it might be. But those big farms are going to require better intel than they're getting at the moment, or maybe getting at the moment. They're going to require very good intel. So the people are going to have the skills to know the intel, but also have the skills to impart that knowledge. And I think that's really very interesting. One of the things I found really fascinating was he was saying something like, the new technology is enabling us to look at each individual cow. Now, in the old days, had 100 cows, like an island, you can tell them by name. You can look at them and say, yeah, I like those eyelashes. That's Daisy, and that's Mavis, or whatever it might be. Now they have these halters on, these things around their necks, which have information, a little thing underneath them, transmitter, and that can tell you by looking at your computer where Daisy is, how much she's eaten today, how much milk she's given, all that sort of stuff. I said to him, it's quite interesting. You're now doing what you used to do 60 years ago. You're actually managing each cow individually, aren't
yes,
you?
Yes, that's true.
And it's really interesting. He said, my God, you're right.
Yeah.
But here we are. We've gone the full cycle almost. We've actually come back to the realization that we actually need to know what each cow is doing, not just treat them as a bunch of animals out there in the paddock, because if a cow is not doing well, we need to be able to treat it straight away. So you can tell, is it how many hours is it resting, how many hours is it feeding, when is it going to the trough to get water, how long is it taking to get to the milk, how much milk is it producing, all that's contained on a computer.
Yeah.
And the average farmer now, many farmers spend 80% of their time, managers, at a computer.
Wow, that's amazing.
It is. It's quite challenging. So that, I think, was quite interesting. But, he said that the consultancy will be different. Some of the bigger ones will bring these specialists on board, Some of the smaller consultancies may continue as they are and maybe bring in people to help them in certain areas where they need some complex answers, because there will still be some smaller farms. They won't all be big family corporates, but we are seeing a move towards that in the sector, as we're seeing it in horticulture as well, where this is a phenomenon right across the agricultural sector. Bigger entities, chances to get investment into them, get better equipment in, more capital, more efficiencies, meeting the prices of the consumer, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, interesting one, isn't it?
It is.
So, yeah, that was a fascinating piece of information from James. And I think one that will be, this will be a paper, I believe, that will have has implications for, of course, for our universities. How do they teach for that?
Yeah.
Will they have to change some of their courses? And that's the matter that he will, I know he's having discussions with Lincoln and Massey about that, as to how his ideas and his knowledge is going to have to be incorporated somehow in those programs. Interesting.
It is interesting. Now, you were talking to me as well about Māori agribusiness.
Yeah,
your course on that.
That was one of the, I went about a month ago up to the Institute of Primary Industry Managers Conference in Hamilton for the launch of the Ahu Whenua Trophy for 2025, the Sheep and Beef Trophy, which is a big event, which is being launched, and we are now calling for entries for that competition. And the winner of that will be announced in Palmerston North in June the 6th next year. So it sounds like we're a year to go almost, but we've still got to be into it. But one of the interesting things at that conference was they ran a whole session on Māori agribusiness, and it coincided with the fact that the Waikato University is now going to run a program of Māori agribusiness, incorporating into their Bachelor of Agricultural Business or Agricultural Business. So Māori will be a part, agribusiness will be a part of that. So the aim is being, the reason for it is this, and it's an interesting one. Agricultural consultants are saying that they are not getting enough people in there available who actually understand how Māori entities work. And they're getting a lot of business from those people. The Māori entities are big consumers of consultancy. Not all of them, but a lot of them rely heavily on it. But getting people trained who have got the skills to relate to Māori, understand Māori agri, how Māori operate, is important to them. So this course is aimed at trying to get those people, dare I say, industry ready when they walk out of that university, and they can go into those consultancies and immediately become able to work in the field competently. We are seeing in most organisations now, there are Māori specialists attached to pretty much every organisation I deal with, and they're there to give advice around Māori. But the consultancy is a different thing. It's saying we need a bigger pool of people to be able to do that job. And this course is really very, very interesting. It's just to see that there is a recognition among consultants themselves that this is the case. And I thought the other thing for us in Ahu Whenua was we were quite delighted to do it at that conference, because we got to a group of people who are very, very dealing with Māori a lot, consultants. They're a big part of what we do, and they hope they're going to be some of our advocates for getting entries into the competition this year, which we're hoping to do. And we're looking for a good cohort of entries and a very good, strong competition yet again in this area.
I'm sure. Well, that's great. That's good news.
Yeah.
That's really good news. All right, talk to me about how some consumers in some markets are getting confused.
Yeah, this is interesting. We all thought technology is great, and I was talking to some people the other night about what you can do, what a barcode or a Q code or whatever it is.
QR code.
I should have known me that. Anyway, my technology is low. Anyway, what's happening now is that people, consumers in countries, say Japan, someone was talking to me just last night, the other, saying about they were working for a company where a whole fish is sent to Japan, has to be there within 24 hours. But as well as that, they attach to that packaging a QR code, which means that someone who touches that, scans that, could tell where that fish was
caught,
raised, etc., 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 right through. So it's about provenance.
Yeah.
And that's good. The challenge is, of course, that everyone's doing it now, and the poor old consumer in China was going to their supermarket with their cell phone and getting all these mixed messages. And it's a case of, is mine better than yours? New Zealand's got a challenge here because everyone's saying their product is better than ours and we're saying ours is better. What we do know for a fact is that, that the Chinese are interested in a thing called grass-fed, because for a long time it was said that grain-fed is good for you. Well, we all know it just produces fat. It's lovely. American steak tastes beautiful as long as you like fat. Wonder why there's obesity. Whereas they actually import New Zealand beef to make their rather fatty beef more lean in the hamburger, which they predominantly eat. But the question now becomes is, how can you get your message across more effectively? And that's a problem that we're, that New Zealand's going to have to unpick in terms of the consumer now, to get a message very clear. Coming up in November, there's going to be a launch of a big campaign, a country of origin campaign in China, which is going to go ahead, which will promote the New Zealand meat as a New Zealand brand, and then extol, as part of that, extolling the benefits of that meat, which is it's grass-fed, it is, we are a sustainable country, our meat is produced perfectly, it's a sustainable way, everything along the whole value chain from farm gate right through processing and through to the plate is cannot be beaten by any of the other competitors, and we can prove that. We've got the data now, tracking data to prove that. So that's something that's going to be there. But the person who gave us that information was a chap from Rabobank, and he's saying that, you know, there's some issues in China which we've got to remember, and it's something we've but forget about in our quarter acre, half gallon Pavlova paradise. That's what Austin Mitchell called us about 50 years ago. But the Chinese live in a small apartment where there is very limited cooking facilities, and they don't know how to cook. So we're going to have to, and we are already doing it, providing ready-to-eat meals, ready-to-cook, something you can put in the microwave, which looks good, and when it comes out, looks equally good, even better. And that's what is going to have to happen, that we're not going to be able to get the Chinese consumer to have a kitchen like we might have in New Zealand, and they don't have the time to as well. They just want to go to the supermarket, buy a meal, put it in the bag, go home and cook it, put it in the microwave, have a delicious meal in front of them. Now, we've got some of that in New Zealand a little bit with my food bag, a few other bits, I think, but this is quite different. Question being, the food must be convenient, it must be healthy, and I think he's saying this packaging, this whole thing together, is going to be the challenge for New Zealand in the future. And I talk to the meat companies, they're doing it already, and they're doing a very good job. You've got to hand it out to our New Zealand meat processing companies, the Silver Fern Farms and all the others, are doing a great job in that. They have been doing it for years. But just the message that we've got to be important to be looking at that. And also then looking at things such as lamb. Lamb is a challenge at the moment. It's not an easy meat for anyone to cook. I mean, even in New Zealand, I remember years ago, a friend of mine came to me and said, can you give me a recipe for how to roast a lamb? And I just about died on the spot. But anyway, but that's true of a lot of people, and it's true of those people. So it's a matter of getting lamb in a position in those supermarkets where it can be readily presented, ready to cook, ready-to-eat product. And I think as we go forward, these are some of the challenges that are going to come out. We've got China was a big challenge for us, as we know. There has been the COVID crisis has not ended really in China. Talking to people about that, they're still saying the mood is a bit better. We've bottomed out a little bit in terms of what's gone wrong, but we're not halfway up the ladder yet. It's getting better, but it's going to be a slow process to get to the top. And I think a lot still hinges on China, but we can't walk away from China. They're a very important market for New Zealand. Politically, it's important for New Zealand. And in terms of the red meat sector particularly, and the dairy sector, of course, China is important. There's no walking away from China at the moment at all. We will diversify, yes, and that's already underway. But to walk away from China is a bit like we can't walk away from Britain. We never have. We still are there. And that will be a market. Just how good it will be in the future, it's like, this is just a cyclical thing. I've watched this happen over 50 odd years. It's just in this cycle. It will come. It's probably the worst cycle it's been, but it will end. It may not be better than it may not be back to where it was, but it will be back somewhere where it is possibly manageable and people can get on with life.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for coming in today. I look forward to finding out what happens next round. See you then.
Bye-bye.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.org.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.